to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I tell everybody, I'm sober 22 years, and sometimes I still struggle with the wisdom to know the difference. But I want to like to extend the greeting to everybody here at the conference. And I'm going to read you the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and to help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. We do not wish to engage in any controversy. We neither endorse nor oppose any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Can we please have the 12 steps?
My name is Mildred. I am an alcoholic from Toronto. My home group is the Rocks Glen Traditional. We meet on Monday and Thursday. Please come and see us if you come to our fair city. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973. And I'm delighted to be here, and to look out at this group is just absolutely amazing. I'm so excited to be able to share with you not my story, but my experience, strength, and hope, because I do have experience in all kinds of areas. I do have strength, and I do have hope. Yesterday was my 44th anniversary. And thank you. And I don't say that with any kind of pride in myself. I say that in the pride of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the name of the grace of God, and what happens to us through this wonderful experience we have together. You know, I thought about that last night, because when we came to dinner, Lori G. had made sure there was a cake there. Congratulations to Mildred on her 44th anniversary. And I thought about something, because there were about 25 of us in the room. And I thought, you know, it's one thing to celebrate by yourself. It's another thing to celebrate with other people. And then to be here tonight and to celebrate it with this crowd is just extraordinary. So it's wonderful to be here. And I suppose there are some of you saying, 44 years sober, what has she got to say to me? I'm 44 days sober. Is there anybody here under 1 year sober? Fantastic. You know, don't be intimidated by somebody who says they're 44 years sober. Because life is life, and I have to experience life one day at a time, just like you do. You experience it with what you know, I experience it with what I know. But in the end, it's all about the grace of God and how we let that in. You know, a couple of weeks ago, somebody said to me, we're going on a tour of Lourdes. And if you don't know what Lourdes is, it's a place where miracles are said to have happened, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, would you like to go with us? And because I have a history with the Catholic Church, as you will hear, she thought I might be interested, and I said, no, thank you. And I thought about it. Why don't I want to go to Lourdes? Because I don't have to go to Lourdes. When I sit at a meeting like this, if you are the kind of alcoholic that I am, then I am looking at a bunch of miracles. And I don't care if you're sober 44 years or if you're sober 44 hours. The grace of God has got you by the balls. It sure has me. And I'm real happy about that. And so, you know, I don't have to go some other place, because when I come here, I do see that there are the lame who now can walk, the blind who now can see, and the deaf who now can hear, and I'm one of them. I am the outcast who now live with dignity, who live a decent life and am respected in AA and respected in my community at large. I used to say I'm an oddball, I'm going to die an oddball. Not true. I'm a wonderful person today, and that's the way I'm living, and that's the way I plan to end this life. Maybe 50 years from now. So, there's a wonderful man in the program in North Carolina. His name is Tom Ivester. And Tom is sober, I think, 57 years, somewhere in that area. And when I was new, I was in Prince Albert in Saskatoon, and Tom used to come out there because he married a girl from Prince Albert. And he took an interest in me, and he took me aside one day. And this is the theme of what I'm going to talk about. He said to me, "Mildred," he said, "I think you need to hear what I'm going to tell you." He said, "I had a plan for my life when I got sober." And he said, "The plan that I had went up in smoke." But he said, "What instead I found was that there was a power of good that has never let me down and that has guided me." And I still remember his hand going just like mine is. He said, "It has guided me in ways and in places I did not expect to go." And he said, "You can trust that." And he said, "I think you will experience that." And I can tell you, I have not got the smarts to bring my life from where it was to where it is today. What do we really do when we say we're going to share our experience, strength, and hope? This is where I was, and that's how I behaved, and to the best of my ability, some of the ideas that I had then. This is what happened, and now this is what is going on. That's what I'm here to share. So, I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan, the youngest of 10. We were Roman Catholic, obviously. And I think it feels to me as if I came to the planet disturbed. By the time I was 3, I was crying. And I don't have a horror story. I wasn't abused and I wasn't molested and all kinds of things. I was raised, I was a lot younger than the others, and they made a fuss over me, they loved me, they cared about me, but something wasn't right. Somebody crawled into my bed at night and she would cry. It was my retarded sister, and I'm going to mention just a little bit of childhood, because this isn't what made me an alcoholic, but it is what has dogged my life and I think has forced me to do the spiritual work that has ultimately been my salvation. She had been injured at birth, and so she couldn't learn as fast as other kids, and so she was kept in grade 3 till she was 16. I don't need to read you a whole big story to tell you what happens to a kid who's 16 sitting with grade 3s, and they make fun of her, and her name was Dorothy. They called her Dumb Dora, and she cried. I don't care who you are, you need comfort. And she crawled into bed with me because I cried with her. And I'm telling you, if you'd taken a 2x4 and hit me, it wouldn't have hurt as much as that did. And even then, I knew I have to get this fixed. So where did I go? I went to the big brothers and sisters I had. They had always loved me, and I knew they were going to do it. And then the crying didn't stop. What I understand now is they couldn't fix it. Then my interpretation was they wouldn't fix it. And I learned to look at the world. Nobody cares about me. If you've got a problem, nobody helps you. The world is a scary place, and there doesn't seem to be anything you can do about it. But keep trying to find somebody. And see, if I were to write a statement or two about my life for a lot of years, that was the story that I would have written. I've got to find somebody who's going to make me feel okay. And I'll tell you, when you do that, you will leave your soul strewn around the planet. I guarantee you. And you will wind up the way I wound up. There wasn't much that I wouldn't do if I thought that maybe you would like me and you would approve of me and I would feel better. So that's where I was. And then I went to God, because we were Roman Catholic, we went to church. And somehow or other, I had the idea God was love and God was power, and I went to God and I gave him instructions. Try that one on for size. You can add that to the list of things that don't work. And so I was confused. The God that I knew made sunsets. The God that I knew made the aurora borealis. The God that I knew made all kinds of wonderful things in nature that I saw. And I didn't understand. If you can do that, why can't you fix my sister? See, I think one of the things in life is the experiences we have that teach us. Because I don't think that way anymore. I love that, but I don't think that that power is going to change me against my will. I've got to be cooperating with that. And there is a purpose for my being here. And I didn't know that. So at 5, I took a drink. And I'm going to spend about 10 minutes telling you about my drunken life. Well, maybe 15. That's enough to give you an idea that I stand here. I am a dyed-in-the-wool alcoholic. My father made homebrew, and one night, I didn't know what that stuff was, but it was very cute. Little Mildred poured the drinks, and little Mildred poured some into herself, and little Mildred went traveling. The nasty world went away, I thought. It felt like that. It felt okay. I could handle Doris crying. I could handle the way I felt. I could handle the fact that I felt nobody cared about me and that the world was really a place that sucked, if you want to know the truth. I loved it, and that's what I chased for the next 35 years. That took me to a park bench. I know what a park bench is like because I lived there. I don't look like somebody who does that. But I guarantee you, I lived like a tramp on a park bench eventually. That's not where I started out, because I come from a family known for its integrity and its decency and all of that. But I couldn't abide by that. So anyway, you drink different when you're 5. But I knew, I knew where everybody's booze was. I made it my business because I stole, I lied, I cheated, and there went my alcoholism. I never fit. I think about life as me chasing somebody who's going to like me. And that too went away when I drank. It just seemed to me the world loved me when I drank. I finished high school when I was 14. You know, I'm a klutz when it comes to sports. I'm the top of the line when it comes to head stuff. And that has not worked on my behalf, I can tell you. Because when you come into AA and you say, I know, K-N-O-W, you've got the biggest problem ever. And that's one of the reasons why it has taken me so long to be cracked wide open so that the fullness of God's grace, the fullness of the program, could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I finished high school at 14. I couldn't get into university, so I hung around town. My parents lived by this time in a small town, and I hung out with a bunch of boys. We all belonged to a choir, and they loved me. This was the part of my drinking that I really enjoyed. We were wild. They used to say, "You're so wild. We really like you." And I loved being wild, and I had a good time. And then one of the girls in the choir spoiled it. One night she announced she was going to be a nun. And everybody made a big fuss, and all the attention came off me. Didn't like that. And I waited. And about 2 weeks later, I announced, "I'm going to be a nun." And everybody laughed. They thought it was a joke. So once you do that, I can't go back now. So I went to the boarding school where I went to high school, and one of the nuns said to me, she said, "You don't belong in a convent." I still remember she was doubled over with laughter. She said, "Go to university, that's where you belong." I went to the hospital in our town. They laughed at me. I went to our pastor, he laughed. Now I've got a problem. I've got to get into a convent. You know, talk about spiritual motive. Not there. And I knew where the swinging convents were, because I needed a swinging convent. They were in the States. So I wrote to the United States. I bet I wrote 25 letters. Finally, I got one, and they said, "You can join our convent in near Hamilton, Ontario." And so we packed my stuff. My family was horrified. They didn't want me to go. But anyway, we packed my stuff, and my brother and I, my alcoholic brother and I, took the train. In those days, you didn't fly much, because that was the early 50s. And I joined, and I was drunk the night I entered, and I stayed drunk for 15 years. People say, "Well, how do you stay drunk in a convent?" My question to you is, are you really an alcoholic? You know, I don't know where you could put me that I wouldn't find a way to get drunk, somehow or other. One time, Mother Superior sent me to a little place where there were only 5 people, and she thought she'd keep me sober there. Sure fooled her. Anyway, I stayed in that convent. I'm grateful. I have no horror stories about nuns and the convent and the church. That isn't it. They did me only good. They tried to help me. This was the 50s. And you know, Mother Superior, I remember her saying, "We're going to break you, and then we're going to build you up." That was traditional monastic talk, so don't feel that was horrible. And but after 15 years, I learned something. I learned how to do I love spiritual reading, and it stands me in good stead to this day to study the great masters. I did that. I also, you know, I loved the organ. I loved the church classical music. And at the end of that time, Mother Superior said, "And you know, I think you'll appreciate the fact I always had all the jobs in the church. And if I drank too much, I could hide out in the confessional." It was a good place to sleep it off. And the best part of it was nobody thought to look for me there. Where's Sister Eugenia? I don't know. Well, anyway, I left the convent, and with all my education and all my smarts, it was January the 10th, 1966, and I thought I was okay. I still remember thinking, now I've got my secular name back, I'm dispensed from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, had fiddled around with them as necessary anyway, and I was dressed in my secular clothes, and I'm okay now. Well, in 2 days, I needed to drink. I found the bars, I found the men, and the men found me. And they thought it was marvelous having an ex-nun in the bars. And in that 10-month period, I won't go into that, I lived a life of degradation, such as I can't even begin to describe. And at the end of it, I couldn't stand who I was and what I was. And I signed myself into an insane asylum. Now, that was not a new idea, because I had been locked up 32 times in psych wards. And there, they used to tie me to the bed, and it was not for fun and frolic. And I always had therapy. But we always talked about what was wrong with you. I didn't know there was anything wrong. I had no idea. You know, in step 10, where Bill writes, it's a spiritual axiom that if I'm disturbed, I'm the one in error. I'm the one that has to change. I didn't know that. I thought if you would change, I'd be okay. And I'll bet there are a few of you out there aren't totally aware of that truth yet. Hang around, and you too will be 44 years sober. And you will know that statement is absolutely true. Anyway, in the psych ward, my brother found me, and my family was horrified that I was in. There's a difference between a psych ward and an insane asylum. And he took me out, and he said, remember what Tom said, there's a spirit that guides. He said, do you want to go to Regina or do you want to go to Saskatoon? Why did I say Saskatoon? I know now that spirit was guiding me because there were two men there who were part of my destiny. One was Dr. Hoffer, who suggested that I go to AA. He said, she doesn't have these psychiatric illnesses. She should go to AA, she's an alcoholic. And that happened, and I was happy, because prior to this, my father had called and said, my brother had gotten sober, and he said, he's not gonna die. He said, there's a new organization. You know, you young people, you can't even imagine this, where recovery wasn't the talk of everyday language. And my father said, it's a new organization. He said, I don't know what it is, but he said, it's so good, and he started to cry. He said, your brother has been transformed. And my dad didn't talk like that, so I paid attention. And he said, your brother now works. This was a very good sign, in my dad's opinion. So the other man I needed to meet was a psychiatrist, the man who was to become my husband. I mean, if you're as crazy as I am, that's what you need to do, is marry a psychiatrist. Sex and therapy in one shot seemed like a good deal. Have to have a drink on that one. So I went to AA. It was 1966. I was in Prince Albert. And if you know anything of our history, you know that some of the strongest members, we stand on their shoulders today. People like Cease Corrigal, who was 62 years when he died. And he was there at the time. And he was one of the trustees, and he drew in people like Chuck Chamberlain and Wesley Parrish and Mac Cheater. I owe part of my life to those men. They were so wonderful. I'll tell you one little story about Cease. See, I came into AA. I was there 3 weeks. And I sat where you're sitting, Jim, front row, waiting to be transformed. I didn't know who was going to do it. I didn't know how it was going to happen. But by God, my dad said it happened, so I waited. 3 weeks went by, and I'm sitting there with my untreated alcoholism. This is not good news. So I need something to help me along. So I sat in AA 5.5 years stoned. It is not something I recommend. It kind of twists the way you hear things. then it gives you permission to do all kinds of things. I ran around with everybody I could. I had a really good time. Some of the women didn't, I tell you. I was a bad girl. And at the end of that period, I just felt so ashamed of myself. I left AA. And I thought, everybody's doing it right. And again, I mean, I'm not crazy. Honest, I'm not. I knew that something, I wasn't doing it the way you folks were doing it. And Chuck used to take me aside. Chuck would come to Prince Albert often. And Chuck would say, Mildred, you have only one problem. And I would say, Chuck, no. I said, you know, I need money, I need a man, I need sex, I need success, and so on. He'd say, no, you have one problem. You think you're separate from God. And until you get that right, he said, you will be the way you are. And I can't help you. I can't make it happen. But that's where you need to go. And you know what? I believe that today. If I'm not right with God, page 164 says it. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And then great things will come to pass for you and countless others. That's the order. It doesn't say you get the good things and then you'll pray. That's what I wanted to do. Anyway, I drank again. And so, you know, I wound up, we lost everything. My husband had been director of a hospital. That went by the boards, the cars, the houses, the housekeepers, and all the fancy lifestyle right down the tube. And I wound up on a park bench. And absolutely nothing. Nothing left, nobody left, and so on. So I was on that park bench. You know, and I should say this. You know, I thought, I'm going to leave AA and I'm going to be okay. I don't need this stupid organization. I was gone 2 days. And somebody had locked me on a second story window, and I broke the window, dropped a chair down because I thought it would be safer, jumped onto the chair, broke 2 feet of mine. And that was the success of that. So, on the morning of May the 18th, the police picked me off apart the park bench. I had been living there as a tramp. You know, when I say this part, I never want to forget this part. That was me. That was the me that stands here today. And if you read the book, you know, when I read the book today, the first 70 pages are full of this. No human power can fix what's wrong with me. What's wrong with me, I'm not down a quart. What's wrong with me? My unmanageability is inside me. My defiance, my need to control, my need to make other people over and all that kind of stuff. That's my problem. But all of that I didn't know at that point. So picked me off the park bench, took me to a psych ward, and I woke up in there finally. And the morning of the 20th, so the 18th is my dry date. The morning of the 20th, the nurse, I finally could walk. She took me to breakfast, and I saw myself. So I kept my word. I spent 20 minutes talking about the disease. I think you know I'm legitimately here, right? Okay. So she said to me, because I saw myself, teeth knocked out, straggly hair, a big, thick, swollen eye, and a big mark on my face. And she said, I said to her, I've become a woman of the streets, haven't I? And she said, yes, you have. And she asked me one of the most important questions anybody has asked me. She said, what are you going to do about it? We went to breakfast, and after breakfast, I took an inventory. What am I going to do about this? And this is what I saw. I felt, and I had, that I had given life the best shot I knew how. I had done education. I had done church. I had done convent. I had done music. I had done success. I had done all kinds of things, and none of it had given me peace of mind. I had not achieved what I set out to do. Where was I? I was homeless. I was penniless. There was no money stashed anywhere. There was nothing left. There wasn't a person that I could call. And I don't say that out of any kind of self-pity. That was the truth. I was out of everything. Did I pray? No. Why would I pray to God? He didn't fix my sister. Why is he going to fix this? And so I gave in. There's a statement in the big book that I love, and I remind myself of it many times in life. It says, I have to concede to my innermost self. I don't have to concede to you. See, all my life, I would concede to you. Yeah, I'm a bad girl. Yeah, I'm this. Yeah, I'm that. And that didn't get me anywhere, because all I was trying to do was manipulate you to give me what I thought, and I know now you can't fix me. You're not my problem, and you're not my solution. And so I conceded to my innermost self that day. Not that I was alcoholic. I could have done that 20 years ago. I knew that. What I conceded to my innermost self was, I do not know how to live life. God, that's a big one. You know what I believe today? I believe God says to me, look, honey, I didn't design you to know what to do. I designed you so that you would be in touch with me on a regular basis so I could show you and tell you what to do. I designed you that way. And that morning, I got it. I conceded. I don't know how to live. I didn't pray the traditional way. But I tell you, this is the most important thing that has happened to me. And it's the most important, the crucial thing, because I gave in. I don't believe in a God who says, well, Mildred, today you're going to be sober. What about the person out there? I don't believe in that God. I believe that that spirit waits for us to give in. And when we give in and open the door, grace has no problem fixing. Because that morning when I gave in, 1 minute, I stood there ready to go and commit suicide. I had asked the nurse to go get my coat. I knew it. Half an hour, I'm gone. I mean, if you're going to commit suicide, you should be warm at least. But I really, that's what I was going to do. And instead, as I stood there, something happened to me. In one flash, 1 minute, I'm the person standing there saying, I don't know how to live. In the next minute, I stood there, and as I stand here, I still can experience that. I was absolutely changed. No compulsion, no obsession. I was 40 years old, and I bet the mathematicians are saying, 40 and 44, she's 84. You're damn right I am. And if you want to take me on, I challenge you. The compulsion and the obsession was taken. It was taken. 1 minute I'm one way, and the next minute I'm another way. You know, I've come to this. I've studied a lot, I've read a lot. I don't know who God is, but I'll tell you one thing. I believe what Tom said. There's a power of good, bigger than I, bigger than you, bigger than everything, because this really happened. There, you know, all my life, I had all kinds of people around me saying, you should do this, you should do that. And in that heartbeat, the compulsion and obsession was taken. And I swear to you that in 44 years, I've struggled with all kinds of stuff, but never with that. Never has the thought crossed my mind that maybe it's a good idea that I drink again. That's done. And I remember standing there saying, I don't have to drink anymore. I knew that. See, I think there are times, and we should be aware of that, when the Spirit talks to us, when the Spirit touches us, and not be foolish and say, well, I don't know. I knew that morning that I didn't have to drink again, that I didn't have to drug. I knew I was clean, but I remember saying, I hear my voice when I say this. I don't know how to live sober. What a piece of truth that was. And I'll bet you there are people here who drank again for the very same reason. They were sober and one day they didn't know how to live sober and it looked like a good idea. I knew that. I don't know how to live sober. You'll have to send me somebody. And there was a rap on the door and a man stood there and by God, he was there. And he said, I saw you at breakfast. And he said, are you in trouble? Are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes, you want to make something of it. He said, no. He said, I came to see if I could help you. And the next day he took me to see, again, our world today doesn't know a world where there were no treatment centers. There were no treatment centers in 1973. But there was a hospital budding treatment center started by a man named Dr. Bell, who saw that there were probably people who needed some help. And so this man said, there's Donwood, and he said, I'll take you tomorrow. And he took me. And at that time, I think the cost was $2,000. And when you don't have 2 cents, it might as well be the, you know, Dr. Bell. Things started to happen different. Different people started to pay attention. I still hear his voice yelling down the corridor saying, keep that woman here and give her a bed. And that's what happened. And I stayed there for 28 days. And it was the, you know, when I look at my life, all I can see is the perfection of the way things happened. They didn't push AA. I hated AA. I hated God. They didn't push any of that. They fed us, they gave us some therapy, you know, that kind of stuff. But it was 28 days without a drink. And I was with a different kind of person. And when I was finished, they gave me enough money to get a room on Skid Row. I didn't know about Skid Row. I could write a book on that now. I went into that room and I remember going, because I was to live there for a year. Totally unlike the digs you've provided, Dan. By the way, Dan, you're quite a special man. Thank you so much for everything. Just been wonderful. Communicator. We can always be grateful for the leaders God provides us. You're the best. And anyway, there was a psychiatrist at the institution who took an interest in me, and I had to walk 8 miles to get there. I went once a week, and for some reason, God puts people in our lives, and he encouraged me. I don't remember what we talked about, but I was living on Skid Row. He said, you have to get a job, and I went pounding on doors, and a day and a half went by, me saying, I'll wash dishes, I'll scrub, I'll do anything. And a man said, I've got a factory and you can come and sweep the floor. And that's what I did. And I was hungry that first year and I was alone. And for 6 months, that's the way I lived. I didn't go to any meetings or anything, but I stayed sober. And I could write a book on that experience. I think it was the start of the demolition of the ego. You know, our book says what the problem is. The root of the problem is self. And I can tell you there was not much going on in my life. Get up in the morning, put on those old clothes that you have, go sweep the floor, and be grateful if you've got a piece of bread to eat that day. I don't say that with any self-pity. 6 months went by, and one day a man asked me to come to a meeting. I didn't know where we were going. We were going to a meeting of AA, and I fell in love. I fell in love because by that time, see, I was starting to be cracked open so that I was starting to see a little different. And I got a sponsor, she got drunk, and then two men did me the great favor from the group. They stepped up to the plate because I didn't have another sponsor right away. And they said, "You, Mildred, are too sick to stay if you don't do the steps." I'm not one of those who think we should wait till somebody is sane to do the steps. I think that if you sit down and talk and explain, as they did to me, and they read the book to me, there's power in those steps. I believe that absolutely. And you know, when people come to me today and say, "Should I go to therapy?" My first question to them is, "Have you done the steps, or will you sit down and do the steps with me?" Because that's what those men did. They said, "Come 3/4 hour early, we'll read the book to you, and we'll tell you what to do." And that's how I did the steps. And you know what? The grace of God was powerful, and I got to stay. I got to stay. You know, nowadays we pull out the dictionary and we go to step studies, and there's a lot of that stuff, and I'm not saying it we shouldn't have it, but if you don't do the work, and that's what they insisted, that every day they'd give me an assignment, and then when I came back the next week, it was the work that I did, and I had to write out my fourth step, and I've still got a copy of it. And it's a pretty damn good fourth step, I can tell you. It touched all the sore spots, some of them that I still have, as a matter of fact. So at the end of that time, see, I think I've learned, do the best you can where you are with what you've got. I did my sweep the factory floor, and on the day off, I tried to get another job. And I think that's what kept me going. And at the end of that time, I got a teaching job, and I went back to my career. I'm a high school and college teacher, and by a series of God shots, I got a teaching job. Three ads in the paper, the first call I put in, I got that teaching job. And that's when all hell broke loose in another way. Because now, I'm working with normal, I shouldn't say that. I'm working with people who haven't had my experience, and they don't care about my experience. I'm just another teacher on staff, and they want me to do my job. And I didn't know how to handle teenagers. All I could do was yell, because if they didn't do what was right, I felt threatened. Now I've got another sponsor, and he's got a size 16 shoe. And he doesn't mind using it. And he doesn't care how I feel. He said to me, and you know, he just died. He was 57 years sober. He died 2 years ago. And I owe that man my life, because he understood. He had a 5-year-old on his hands, a 5-year-old who was 41 years old and didn't know how to live in the regular world, and he taught me how to do relationship. He said, instead of yelling at those kids, why don't you tell them? He said, tell them that when they don't do what you ask, you feel threatened. Oh, I said, I couldn't do that. I said, they just make fun of me. He said, try it, and I did. And their response was, oh, miss, that's not right. We like you. We're just a little wild. And we became close friends, and I learned a really powerful lesson. How about telling the truth when you deal with people? You know, and it's something that he insisted that I learn to do. that instead of pretending and trying to be something I'm not, that I start to tell the truth and start to build relationships. At the end of 7 years, I had paid off my debts, but I had no money saved. He made me pay off my debts. Can you believe that? I said, I don't want to give them my money. And he said, they don't want your money. They want theirs with interest. So 7 years went by. I'm now divorced. And in the meantime, also, I've had a little tussle with Al-Anon. I had a boyfriend who was sober. And after he started a relationship with me, he drank. I don't know if there's a message there. But I said, I know how to be sober. I'm going to teach him. Well, that was an interesting experience. 3 years later, I come home from work. He got into my house. He's lying on my bed saying, Millie, get me some beer. And I said, I don't want to get you beer. I said, you pray. He said, I don't want to pray. Well, now picture this. I'm standing. I'm strong. He's lying. He's shaking. I grabbed his ears. And I pounded his head on the bed, and I said, you pray, you son of a bitch. And then I went to Al-Anon for a while. It's interesting about that, because for all my worrying that poor man, when we finally broke up, I thought he's going to kill himself without me. And instead, after 6 months, he was sober, and he had 16 wonderful years as an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous before he died, and all without me. I guess there's a message there, isn't there? Well, 7 years, and a teacher said to me, you know, you should buy a house. And that's the next piece of my life. For the next 13 years, that's what I did. I'm a teacher, I was doing that. But on the side, I was flipping houses and making a pile of money. And that all happened. I just say that that was a God shot. And I have to say, too, I didn't have a relationship with God at this time. If you saw me on the outside, you would say, that's a good member of AA. I had a home group, which I absolutely believe in. I was active in the program. I was active in my group. I was sponsoring. I had a sponsor. I wasn't sleeping around. I was in relationship with my sponsor. I was a good person, but I didn't have a relationship with God. See, when you believe, you know. Anything I heard, anything I saw, my attitude was, I know more about God than you. I didn't even know that that was my attitude. I do remember the day my sponsor said, you are the stubbornest, most self-centered person it has been my misfortune to sponsor. You find that hard to believe? Anyway, at 21 years, somebody had taken me through the steps. See, nothing happens by chance. It's got to come from in here. And at 18 years, I met somebody, and he took me through the steps. And I started to unravel, because I was a good person. See, I think when you look at your life, you see how you grow. This was necessary, this first 20 years of my life, I think. I learned how to do business. I learned how to live in the third dimension. And was successful at it. And then it's time. God is saying, I didn't make you to run your own life. I designed you so you would be in touch with me and I would show you the way. And so at 21 years, I left my teaching job and I went into a real depression. And because I hadn't prepared for retirement, honest to God, I hadn't. And my sponsor said to me, you're going to keep a routine, and I did, and that saved my life. And one day the phone rang. See, if you look at your life, there's no chance. I don't believe that. I believe that God is here all the time. And I don't always understand that my soul is ready, but one day the phone rang, and it was Father O'Brien, and he said, I want you to come and give a retreat. And I said, I can't do that. I said, you have no idea how many times I've been excommunicated. And he just laughed, and he said, I don't care about that. See, another point I want to make that I didn't understand at the time, often when I am in trouble with something, somewhere the solution is being prepared. He said to me, people have been talking to me about you. They tell me that you're a great educator. And he said, some of the people in the program say, you really understand the spiritual life. And he said, that's a great combination. I want you to come and give a retreat. And I did. And it was crucial that I did. It was 70 women, and I didn't particularly like women, but I did go and do the retreat. The reason it was important was at the close of that retreat, another God shot. I had to be where I was. I'm so convinced of that. Be where you said you would be. Fulfill what you said you would do. It doesn't really matter whether you think it's... I needed to be there because God was waiting for me at the end of that retreat. I'm doing the last talk, and I start to bawl. Not cry pretty the way they do in the movies. I bawled. And words came out of me that I didn't even know the truth of. And the words were, I am the loneliest person in the world. I don't have a friend in the world. And that was the truth. It wasn't self-pity. I knew lots of people. But you can walk around with your mask, which is exactly what I did. I didn't know how to be real. Now I realized I put up those walls when I was a child. And, you know, the way I felt, you would like me to be, so then you would like me, etc. I didn't know how to be real. I really did not know. And there I am in front of 70 women bawling. And the show was up. The feathers came off the chicken. And the chicken had to go forward with no feathers, and I didn't know how. And I have to tell you, that was the start of learning to respect women and to like women, because they came forward. I still remember that. They came forward, and they wanted to hug me, and I kind of backed away from that. And they invited me for coffee. You know, it sounds ridiculous. Maybe you can identify with this. If you have walls, I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to be real. Now, one of the things I love about life is that I can be real. I can be who I am. I can let you see who I am. And also, that's the way we grow. You can't grow from that false idea, you know. Things have changed drastically for me. Then I was at a conference, and this man talked about his life, and he talked about the bondage of self. And he said that his business had not been going well, and he had brought in the experts, and he said, why is the business was well organized? And he said he began to understand that the old beliefs that he had taken on in childhood were his bondage of self. See, the old beliefs that I heard, you know, psychiatrists, doctors say that we have about 50,000 thoughts. We talk to ourselves all the time and wonder what they're doing. I wonder, you know that. And it's that old stuff that is the lies. I think it's the voice of the false self, myself. You know, that stuff that I took on, nobody cares about me, life sucks, life is hard, nothing good ever happens, nothing ever gets fixed, that kind of stuff. If you don't have it, God bless you, I have enough for everybody. And I got interested in that because I knew he was right. I have some of that. And he said, after he talked, I went and talked to him, and he said, yeah, there are ways to deal with that. So I found a teacher, and God put the books and the tapes and the person in my face, and I came to the States, and I worked with this man for 2 weeks, and I got a new lease on life. And everything started to change drastically. This is the process. See, somebody said to me, do you ever get to the place where you feel you're not growing? See, I'll tell you something else that happened. I'm just about finished. At that point in my life, I realized something. I realized that I had no relationship with God. And I realized that I had to start to meditate. Something said to me, either you learn to meditate or you're not going to make it. This is part of it. And I went on a search for finding a way to meditate, to learn about the silence that I could cope with. And that has been my salvation. I'm a meditator now. 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes at night. That's part of my routine. And I also love spiritual reading because when it's all said and done, see, I think my spiritual advisor, he always says we live in two worlds. And I remember Sandy Beach many years. Remember Sandy? I remember the first time I heard Sandy say this. He said, we come into the world in a two-in-one package. Yeah, we come in this body, and we come with our spirits. And he said, most of us pay most attention to the body. And that's what I did for 60 years. I was paying attention. Because you put on a habit and take vows and go to a convent doesn't mean you're doing spiritual work, honeys. And so what I found was that as I began to think like this, this is what I believe today. It's a great gift to live in this third dimension. It's a great gift to have to deal with. And I think that if, as I understand this, I've stopped struggling. You know, our book says it. Many times during the day, we say, thy will, not mine, be done. And if I think my will has to be done, look what the book says in step 3. It says, we thought that we could wrest satisfaction out of this world, satisfaction and happiness out of this world, if only we managed well. And I think the real job is to get rid of self, to learn to love people. And that's what I think. There's so much in the book, like page 55, where it says, deep within, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Doesn't say in some. And you know, when the master was here, he never said we have to like people. He said we have to love them. I always feel if you like everybody, you're on something. Liking is just the outside stuff. But when you can start to see that that life force lives in me and it lives in you. Einstein said it. You know, that's another thing I've learned. The great scientists, they all talk like this. Look what Whitehead said. He said, we have found a strange footprint on the shores of we don't know where. I love that. We have found a strange footprint. It's, you know, I'm trying to talk about what has happened in my soul so that you know, you can identify, like I like to identify with you when you talk. A strange footprint on the shores of we don't know where. And I just love that because I think back to May the 20th, 1973, and that for me was a strange footprint on the shores of we don't know where. It's hard to put words to that, but we do put the best words that we can to that. The last thing that I'll say is, with those changes, my heart has opened up. I feel different about the world now. It doesn't matter. You know, people sometimes say to me, do you think about God all the time? No, I don't. But I have a relationship with God. So God is part of the way I live my life. And part of the way I live my life is you, and how I treat you, and how I think about you, and how I think about myself. I've learned to love myself, because those are the lenses with which, if I hate myself, I'm going to hate you. And so everything has changed for me. My brothers and sisters, there were 10 of us. There are only two of us left. The others are dead. And at some point, I realized something. I had a fabulous family, and I didn't appreciate them. I don't want to make the same mistake today and to be here with you at Cook Forest and not appreciate you. And I do appreciate you. But my brothers and sisters are gone, and one day, I've got 35 nieces and nephews, and one day they gave this dinner party, and I was at this dinner party, and they asked me if would I say a few words. Well, I'm always happy to say a few words. So I told them. I had the chance to tell them what wonderful parents they had. You know, through all the terrible things I did, I did everything that a person can do to disgrace a family. I went to a convent, I left the convent, I left the church. I slept around, I became an alcoholic, and on and on and on and on. You know what my brothers and sisters had for me? Just love. My older brother, he became the patriarch of the family. And he said to me, I remember this, I never want to forget this. And I told my nieces and nephews what great parents they had. And my big nephews, they're all about 6'4". They sat there and cried. And they said, you know, we didn't know our parents were like that, because my brothers and sisters shielded them from me. And they didn't really understand what had happened. And they were so happy, and that was one of my amends to my family. And, you know, if I spend the rest of my life doing for others, of course I do for myself too, but there is no way to repay the goodness that has come into a life. I've tried to share with you where I was, what happened, and kind of what I'm like now. I live alone. I travel a great deal. I always say I give retreats, and I give retreats to the men. I always tell them I'm taking resumes. And I get a few, too. But that's what my life is like. I have a home group, I have lots of sponsees, I have many friends, and my life has moved along to a place where I can say today, I can sit by myself today and be happy to be who I am. That's the gift. So I think about that statement in the big book. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. And those great things, that's my wish and my prayer for you. You've been a wonderful audience. God bless you.